Back again to the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. This is podcast number 324. My name is Ben Stone, and I'm not exactly sure what day this will get published, so it's probably going to be sometime during the first week of June 2013. The reason that I don't know exactly which day this is going to be published is because my wife and I are preparing the motorhome, preparing to hit the road. We're going to be going through Pennsylvania on our way to northern New Hampshire. On our way through Pennsylvania, we're going to be stopping at the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania's convention, where I will be one of three speakers there. Larkin Rose and Jim Bovard will be the other two. And then that'll be in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, this coming weekend of, what is that, the 8th? Yeah, the 8th. And then on to Porkfest that happens between the 17th and the 23rd of this month. So that's not really meant to be announcements, but just to give you an idea of what's going on in the very near future, there may or may not be, after this episode, there may not be any more for a while. We'll be on the road, and I'm not sure exactly how that'll go. We hope to have a connection because we have made arrangements with both Verizon and T-Mobile to have mobile hotspots. So hopefully we'll be able to continue the podcasts. Today is going to be the fourth part in the series Beyond Civil Disobedience, Actions with Purpose Within the Zero Aggression Principle. And I want to emphasize, I've said this before, but I want to emphasize, do not listen to this podcast if you have not heard the first three parts, because some of the basic information that I'm assuming you understand that is contrary to what we've all been taught our whole lives, I've already laid the groundwork for that in the first three podcasts. So if you just hear this one without hearing the first three, you might think I'm insane, or you might think, who knows what you'll think, but just stop right now. You know, shut this podcast down, go to badquaker.com, download parts 1, 2, and 3, and listen to them before you listen to this one. Now, there's something that I probably should have said in the first podcast in this series. It's really important that we all know our role. And I think I mentioned in one of the earlier podcasts that if you look like I look, you know, huge beard, long hair, big giant guy that's very, you know, booming voice and all that, you probably want to keep as low a profile as possible, be prepared for things like cops questioning you and people suspecting you of things. So that's not the kind of a person that should be, you know, doing underground activity of any kind, because I walk into a room and eyes immediately focus on me. People look at me. They think I'm there, you know, for some kind of bad reason or whatever, because people draw negative stereotypes against people who have large beards and a lot of hair and very big and everything. So, so each and every one of us needs to know our role. And just because I'm podcasting, and I'm not doing civil disobedience, or I'm not doing any underground activity, that doesn't make me any better or any worse than somebody who's doing regular civil disobedience, or someone who's doing regular underground activity. There's not a hierarchy of one is better than the other, or one is more important than the other. You know, we're all just doing what we can do, and this is what I can do, and it's up to you to determine what you can do. I'm not asking anyone to do anything, and I'm not asking anyone to risk anything. That's not what I'm here to do. There are going to be people who will choose to make certain risks. It's my job in this to help them understand the level of risk that they're going to be facing, and to point out how valuable it is to maintain what you're doing within the scope of the zero aggression principle. Because if we're behaving outside of the zero aggression principle, then we become the enemy that we hate. So for this reason, everything that we do has to be within that scope of the zero aggression principle. Now, I've been talking about civil disobedience, and it's important to understand, again, civil disobedience is, it has a very useful role. People who do civil disobedience, first off, make sure you understand what you're doing, make sure you understand what the repercussions can and probably will be for your actions. But I have the greatest amount of respect for people who choose to do civil disobedience. I'm not in any way putting them down or saying that they're, you know, what they do is not good or what they do is not meaningful. Civil disobedience, like any other action, can be, you know, it can be useful, it can be harmful, it can be wise, it can be foolish. It's all based on what you do and how you do it and what the purpose is or why you're doing it. But it's important to realize that civil disobedience is a symbolic or ritualistic violation of the law rather than a rejection of the system as a whole. And again, I've referred to John Rawls, who has done extensive, he's dead now, but he's done extensive scholarly writings on this to show that civil disobedience is within the scope of true law. It is not outlaw and it is not anarchist. Civil disobedience should be considered in the same category as voting, as petitioning, as lobbying, as speaking out in a town hall, as writing letters to a congressman, or giving political donations or volunteering for a political campaign. If you think about the word civil disobedience, just think about the word disobedience. Disobedience indicates an acceptance of collectivist authority. You see, freedom and obedience are opposites. They're completely two different concepts. You can either be obedient or you cannot be obedient. You can be disobedient. Well, that indicates that there's a slave-master relationship. You can't be free and obedient. It's two different, totally different things. Slaves obey. Slaves are obedient. Free people either choose or decline to choose to cooperate, but it's a matter of a choice to cooperate, not obedience. So the slave is obedient or disobedient, but the free person chooses either to cooperate or not to cooperate. So for this reason, no matter the intention of the anarchist, an act of civil disobedience is an act of protest. Yet, at the same time, it's an acknowledgement of the authority of the government. Now, again, I don't condemn anyone who peaceably engages in civil disobedience. But no matter what the activity you choose to involve yourself in, always weigh the consequences. Always weigh the cost. Ask yourself if you can afford this. Because if you can't pay the piper, don't join the dance. And really, I want to emphasize that as much as possible. Think about, you know, there was this guy, and those of us who are a little older probably have a more vivid memory of this, but the image is still out there. It's still a very active image. There was this guy in Tiananmen Square in China that stood there in front of those tanks, and a whole line of tanks are coming at him, and he's standing out there with like a grocery bag just getting in their way, and every time they'd move to try to get around him, he'd step over and stay in their way. And this was an act of civil disobedience. And in all likelihood, from the best reports that we have, that guy was probably executed at a firing squad about 14 days after that picture was taken, after that footage was taken, along with probably, you know, some of the better, more reliable numbers say probably around 1,000 other students or protesters, students and protesters were shot about the same time frame. So, you know, what he was doing was civil disobedience. It was an act of desperation. It was an act of protest. But one way or the other, the cost of that was the ultimate. He paid the ultimate price for that act of civil disobedience. So once again, I want to emphasize how important it is to know the cost ahead of time. Know know the worst case scenario. What could happen out of any action that you're going to take? Now, I also wanted to mention again, this is a little bit of a recap, but I wanted to mention again that things like agorism, black markets, gray markets, smuggling, prostitution, tax evasion when it's not for protest purposes, none of these things are civil disobedience. They're just not civil disobedience because it's not a matter of protest. People don't engage in prostitution for protest. People don't engage in agorism for protest or black markets for protest. These are methods of a voluntary exchange within a market that doesn't involve government, ignores government. It's not a protest of government. It's acting in spite of government. It's ways to make money within the zero aggression principle. And you might accept these things as being moral, or you might think that they're immoral, or you might have whatever opinion about them. It's important to get the point that things like agorism and black markets and smuggling and prostitution, things like this, these are not civil disobedience. These are just ways to make money within the zero aggression principle. And I want to emphasize yet again, as I've said in each of this series, the vast majority of anarchist activism has to be above ground. It has to be, you know, it has to involve providing for our families, producing wealth so that we can live as good as possible, and working to educate the people around us, the people that we come in contact with, anybody who can hear our message. This is the primary responsibility of the anarchist, first to yourself and your family, and second to the people around you in peaceable ways, both to, you know, create wealth and to share the ideas of anarchism. This is the primary responsibility of the anarchist. When I start talking about underground activity, this is going to be a very minor aspect of anarchism. No matter what, there's going to be anarchists who are just driven from deep inside to go beyond the framework of civil disobedience and to go beyond simple education and go beyond acts of agorism, go beyond the black market. And they're going to actively want to fight. They're going to actively, you know, I said before that they want to go full on Fight Club with this. And so my purpose in this series of podcasts is not to encourage people to do that. It's to say this is going to happen, and if you're going to do this, then you need to do it right, and you need to make sure that what you're doing is within the scope of the zero aggression principle, and that you not allow, our minds are so polluted with so many different wrong things that we're raised our whole lives absorbing through, you know, either maybe bad parenting or schools or television or the media or the government in one way or the other. And it's so important that if we're going to take these actions, we need to really look at them hard and make sure that what we're doing is productive and what we're doing is morally acceptable, and not just go out there and do stuff, you know, blindly, not realizing what the cost could be and not realizing what, you know, what the consequences could be. Now, I did want to say one other thing in our little recap here. I said some statements in one of the podcasts that some people have gotten a little confused about in regards to property. So let me get through this really quick here and just clarify property. You know, property is either owned or it's not owned. There's no middle ground. Property is either owned or it's not owned. Individuals own property. Now, they may share ownership, like in a marriage or a business partnership. You can share ownership of property. Typically, and I think this is what threw people off, typically, even with shared property ownership, there's usually one of the partners that is a primary owner that ultimately has the decision-making capability over that property. But property can be legitimately shared between individuals, whether it be a business partnership or marriage or some other kind of arrangement. But all of these arrangements are voluntary that we're talking about here. Sharing is a legitimate form of property ownership as long as what we're talking about is voluntary. But no organization of any kind that's based on forced membership has the right to own property. because no organization based on forced membership can in any way be considered legitimate. That means it's impossible for government to legitimately own anything. There's no such thing as public property because the government has no right to own anything. The government is based on aggression, and there's no forced membership. So there's no possible way that the government can rightly own anything. Now, historically, and I've talked about this a lot of times, but historically, prior to the Louisiana Purchase, I'm not aware of any government in history ever owning or claiming to own property. Now, don't get me wrong. Kings owned property, emperors owned property, dictators owned property, pharaohs owned property. But this is all individuals we're talking about who owned property. Some individuals, in most cases actually, where you had a king or an emperor or whatever, they considered everything, like today we would think of the state owning a lot of different things. Well, that was all in the property and the ownership of that one individual, that king or that pharaoh or whatever. But that's very different from a non-entity, an imagined entity like a government owning something through the use of aggression and forced membership. It's a totally different thing. Now, some would make the argument, well, what about the church? The church, you know, the Roman Catholic Church throughout the last 2,000 years. Some people would say, well, what about them? They claim to own things. Well, there's a loophole here. The church claims the right to own things based on the fact that the church believes itself to be the people, the members of the church, which is, I might add, a voluntary association. They represent themselves as being the representatives of Christ on earth. They believe that the church, whichever church that we're talking about, is simply the representative of Christ on earth. Therefore, they believe Christ as the owner of the individual property. So they can make that argument, and it's valid to a certain extent, if for no other reason, it's because these churches are voluntary organizations, and therefore they can share ownership, as I was saying before. But when you think about government owning something, think of, let's say, a government building. To break a window in a government building is not a violation of the zero aggression principle. It may be stupid, it may be unwise, but it's not a violation of the zero aggression principle because no one owns that window. You can't aggress on a window by breaking it if there's no ownership of the window. It's impossible to steal from the government because government has no legitimate claim to property. So theoretically, let's say you were going to let's say you were going to tunnel into Fort Knox in Kentucky, and you know, and try to and get to the gold. Well, as long as you could tunnel into Fort Knox, as long as you didn't harm anybody else's property, any individual's property, you didn't trespass or you didn't harm their property. And let's say that you could tunnel underneath and get into Fort Knox, and you could do that without actually harming anyone, and you could break into the vaults. Assuming there was actually any gold in there, which is questionable, you could homestead any gold in there that you found as long as you didn't commit aggression on any individuals to do it. Because the government doesn't, and I'm not saying people should break into Fort Knox, I'm using that as an example. Government doesn't have the legitimate claim to own any property because government is a forced association. Okay, now I'm going to break here for our commercial break. And when I get back, I'm going to go into what I've been referring to as the Lego distribution network. So stick with me. I'll be right back. Folks, there's only a finite supply of gold and silver in the world. However, politicians can print paper on a whim forever and ever. Hedge yourself against inflation and a volatile stock market by purchasing gold and silver bullion from Amagai Metals. As inflation gets worse, it will become more difficult to buy gold and silver. So secure your financial freedom today by visiting amagimetals.com. That's AmagiMetals.com. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-882-8496. That's 1-800-882-8496, where financial freedom is yours. And be sure and tell them BadQuaker.com sent you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Now, the Lego distribution network, that's what I've been calling the underground anarchy movement of the future that hasn't taken place yet. And again, you know, I'm not comfortable with the phrase underground anarchy, because I'm sure, I haven't Googled it, but I'm sure if you Googled it, there's 10 million people using that phrase to, you know, for everything from maybe violence to, you know, selling t-shirts or whatever. So I'm going to try to stay away from that phrase as much as possible. But the idea of the LEGO distribution network, if you're just tuning in, you haven't heard the previous ones, like I said, you ought to listen to the other ones and things will make sense. But I was talking about, you know, rather than appealing to government through civil disobedience and saying, oh, please, master government, please do these good things for me. Rather than doing that, what we're talking about here, to go beyond civil disobedience, is more like, you know, going out in the dark and spreading Legos around in the carpet so when the government wakes up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, it steps on those with its bare feet and falls down the stairs. That's the Lego distribution network. And it's imperative in this that we adhere to the zero aggression principle, like I've been saying. It's imperative that we reject the collectivist myths like, we're in self-defense against the government, therefore we're justified doing anything we need to protect ourselves. Well, that's collectivist thinking. You're thinking of every employee of the government as being one big faceless blob rather than thinking of them as individuals who act. So if you can get it out of your head of thinking of government employees as one big collectivist blob, and you realize that individuals have to deal with individuals. If you're being individually aggressed upon, then that person is your problem, not a whole mythical group of people made up of collectivist thoughts. And in the same kind of thinking, you have to keep in mind, and I've said this over and over before, that the government is not the enemy of the anarchist. Government is not your enemy. The religion of the state is the enemy of the anarchist. The religion, the beliefs, those myths in the minds of people that justifies their actions, that myth, that religion, that's our enemy. That's the primary thing that we have to deal with. And that's why I say over and over that that any kind of underground activism is far lesser in importance than is above ground doing things like education, confronting people's beliefs with first the moral argument. Government is wrong. Government is immoral. It's based on aggression. Aggression is bad. And the practical argument, collectivism doesn't work. Forced associations don't work. Government can't do anything efficiently. Government fails at everything that it tries. The moral argument and the practical argument and taking care of yourself and your family always have to come first. Now, I was talking about cloaking behavior in reference to the Lego distribution network. I was talking about cloaking, and I was talking about how if a person is expecting themselves to be underground, if a person's going to be involved in things that they need to be underground for, then they need to blend in, they need to look as harmless as possible. And I think I referenced, you know, driving around not in a vehicle with a bad tail light or with a license plate light out or something like that. Not drive around with, you know, a pot sticker on your back window or a, you know, a bad cop, no donuts for you sticker. We don't need that kind of attention if you're in the underground aspects of this. And I mentioned a couple times, I think, in the series so far, I've mentioned bug out bags. And it might be a question that somebody might have. Well, how can you have a harmless looking, you know, SUV or minivan or whatever with some harmless looking people who are really, you know, secret anarchists? How can you have them moving around and have bug out bags in the vehicle and not look suspicious to a cop or something like that? And another question along the same lines is, how can you be comfortable with a bug out bag in a vehicle because that's a target just to get somebody to break your windows and steal the bug out bag? Well, there's a really simple solution to this. You get yourself a kid's backpack, like a strawberry shortcake backpack or a Scooby-Doo backpack or whatever, and you use that as the bug out bag. You can put almost anything in there, but get some crayons and get a piece of paper and draw some kind of happy drawing, maybe with a smiling sun and some butterflies and some flowers, and have that kind of like sticking out of a strawberry shortcake bag, backpack. And then you have you've made a bug out bag that is entirely disguised. And no cop is going to want to open that and look into it. He's going to see that in the back seat, especially if you've got a child seat in there and you've thrown that strawberry shortcake or Scooby-Doo or whatever, SpongeBob, you throw that backpack into that child's car seat. They may lean it one way or the other to make sure there's nothing under it, but unless you've already given them something to be suspicious about, they're not going to make a big deal about it. And what thief in his right mind is going to break a window of a car to steal a strawberry shortcake backpack with a happy drawing sticking crayon drawing sticking out of it? So that's one way to have a bug out bag in your vehicle and not have it at risk of getting your windows broke or a cop getting too nosy. Now, I mentioned violence within the zero aggression principle in previous podcasts. And in this podcast, an example of that is breaking a window of a government building. That is violence that is within the zero aggression principle. It may not be smart. It may be quite stupid to do that. But it's an example of violence that's within the zero aggression principle. Anything that you're going to do, let's just use the window breaking for an example. If you decided that this was the greatest idea ever and you need to break a window, then the zero aggression principle doesn't have a problem with you breaking that window as long as it's not an owned window. And of course, like I said, government property is not owned property. Now you can extrapolate that out for yourself. But violence outside of the zero aggression principle would be like harming an agent of the government that doesn't present a direct threat of aggression against you. You see, it's different if you're being immediately threatened, and then you have to weigh out the consequences and figure out if what needs to be done there. Here's another example of violence. Well, it's not really even violence. Here's an example of something that can happen outside, that is within, I'm sorry, not outside, within the zero aggression principle. That could be a very active tool for someone in the Lego network. That would be blackmail. Now I'm going to read from Walter Block's Defending the Undefendable. And he says, what exactly is blackmail? Blackmail is the offer to trade. It is the offer to trade something, usually silence, for some other good, usually money. If the offer of trade is accepted, the blackmailer then maintains his silence and the blackmailee pays the agreed upon price. If the blackmail offer is rejected, the blackmailer may exercise his right of free speech and publicize the secret. There is nothing amiss here. All that is happening is that an offer to remain silent is being made. If the offer is rejected, the blackmailer does no more than exercise his right of free speech. Again, that's Walter Block, Defending the Undefendable, page 41. And if you haven't read that book, it's really worth not just reading, it's really worth having it on your shelf. I have several copies in different places, and when discussions like this come up with people who are unfamiliar with the concepts, I just will hand them a copy of Defending the Undefendable by Walter Block. Now, there are, when you think about the possibilities within the zero aggression principle, there are all kinds of possibilities that pop into your mind. Situations where if the network were functional, which it is not today, but if there were a Lego network that was fully functional, then when an activist was picked up on some kind of weird charges and it looked like he was going to face 20 years in prison for some, nonviolent thing that the government has framed him on or whatever, when something like this was happening, then, in the right circumstances, the right type of an organization, having certain relationships with, let's say, a judge or a prosecutor could drastically change the outcome of a setting like that, where someone is facing a lot of jail time for some ridiculous nonviolent, victimless crime. Maybe somebody like a police chief or a mayor could be educated in Walter Block's position on that topic. Maybe something like that could influence a certain situation. Am I being vague enough with that? You know, here's some others that are not so obvious ways to use Walter Block's method there, if I can put it that way. What about night guards at a facility that and people need access to? Or what about let's say a situation where data entry is you're dealing with a person who does data entry regularly. And let's say, you know, there are offices in government that are like the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, or, immigration naturalization, or possibly, Border Patrol. There are situations where understanding Walter Block's description here of staying within the zero aggression principle, there are a lot of ways, if you think about it, that these things could be utilized. And you think about a situation like not long ago. Well, here's an actual headline that ran on Fox News. It said, IMF head pointed out in lineup after sexual assault allegations. And this is a situation where a guy that was, right there in the top of the most powerful financial people in the world, another group of people needed to bring him down. So at a key moment, a hotel maid may have been available to him in ways that caused him to misread a signal. And then the next thing you know, this guy's career is over. You see, people in government do this all the time. People at the top levels of corporations do this kind of thing all the time. It's a weapon of our enemy. And by reading Walter Block's Defending the Undefendable, you can see that it's a legitimate weapon. It's a legitimate thing that can be used within the zero aggression principle. And, of course, repercussions if you get caught. You know, I was talking before, too, in other episodes about hackers and how we need to embrace the hacker community, get involved in the hacker community, and how they will be some of our most important allies in the times that are coming upon us. Well, this is true for grifters as well. Grifters are people who essentially, and I'm not sure. We've kind of passed the golden age of grifters, but they're still out there, and there's still some very skilled grifters. A grifter is a person who runs a confidence scam of one kind or another. And people like this are very qualified, just like hackers are qualified for a lot of specific jobs. Grifters, whether they realize it or not, they have this this anarchist tendency within them. And generally what they're doing is within the zero aggression principle. And there's a variety of skill levels that grifters that we could learn from them and we could utilize in situations like this. Again, you have a judge that needs some influence to make a decision on something. Things like this happen. They happen today. They happen regularly. They happen, there are deals cut and there are, there's information held back and there's information released, and these things happen. Again, we need a plausible deniability, and I said it the correct way that time. We need a plausible deniability between the above ground activists and the Lego brigades, because the above ground activists they can't afford to have any association with any of these things whatsoever. And, remember I used the example of Robin Hood of Keene. Robin Hood of Keene is the group of people that goes around and puts money in parking meters that are about to expire, and they put a little note on the person's windshield and say, hey, we did this for you. It's just our service. This is what we did. We saved you some money, and this is a great thing. And we need to look like that. That needs to be the public image of the anarchist. And there's going to be people in this Lego brigade that I'm talking about. They're going to be acting more like the Fight Club. Well, we're putting coins in meters. They're going to be more like the Fight Club. And I mentioned at one point that no one acts alone and everyone acts alone. Now, what I was referring to, you know, and somebody said, well, you know, you're going to have the lone nuts out there. You're going to have loose cannons doing pretty much anything. Well, that's why all of us need to be educated on the zero aggression principle. And we need to emphasize how important it is that we remain to keep all of our actions within the zero aggression principle. And if they're doing that, then yeah, they might be considered loose cannons. They might be caught and be considered a lone nut. But keep in mind, you know, that's a very useful, it's something the government has found, governments have found to be very useful, is the lone nut. They have pretty much perfected that myth and that creation of imagination. And the beauty of the loner is that he can't be connected to a group. Or as soon as you try to connect him to a group, that group immediately dismisses him and says, hey, we don't know that guy. We don't have anything to do with him. I think he tried to hang around. We kicked him out. We don't, you know, you can disassociate, you can disavow anything that that person does. And they come across as the lone nut. And that way the whole organization doesn't go down. The one person takes whatever blunt of the pain, and the rest of us live. And you say, well, that sounds like collectivist. Well, that's why I was saying on other episodes that the people within the Lego movement can't be encumbered by things like possessions and family ties and so forth. Now, also, I wanted to mention, keep in mind the story I told you about Art Sepulveda, this is above ground. This is not necessarily the Lego Brigade, but this is more of the above ground people who are stuck in the system working. And like Art Sepulveda, he would put a lot of effort into looking like he was doing something, but in fact, he was doing nothing. And we can slow down people who work within governments. Can slow the process down just by, you know, like Homer Simpson said, just by doing a really crappy job. Think about during World War II, the German government forced Jews to build rifles. And so here's these Jews in factories being used as slave labor, being forced to build rifles. So what did they do about it? Well, they'd mount the sights slightly off. Or they'd have a slight bend in the barrel or some other thing like that, so that in every way the gun appeared good as it rolled down the line. And yet there was some flaw about it that made it less than useful once it actually reached the battlefield. This was something that these Jews in captivity, being held by the Nazis and forced into slave labor, this was a way that they could just, you know, do their little part to ensure that the Nazi war machine wasn't as effective as it could have been. Now, I was talking a second ago about hackers and how we have to embrace the hackers. And what I'm going to tell you when we come back from this break is how important that can be for us, and how really amazing, how just the act of a few hackers can do some really amazing things. Stick with me. I'll be right back. Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy. Amazon has great prices, and in most cases, you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can even get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of. Plus, it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquicker.com, Amazon will give badquicker.com a tiny portion of the purchase price. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Now, hackers. We need the ability not to steal identities. You know, there's a lot of hackers out there that make a living by stealing identities, stealing credit card numbers and stealing profiles and things like this. That's of no value to us whatsoever. But, you know, if we could create identities within the system, think about it. If a hacker could get into the system and create 1,000 clean, passable identities. Who cares if 1,000 men march on Washington, D.C. with rifles? If you can show me a guy who can create 1,000 clean, passable identities, I'll rock the world. You just think about it for a minute. What if the Lego Brigade could have a small group of people with perfect paperwork, and they could move into and out of the Matrix as they needed? They could appear with perfect identities, do what they needed to do, and when they needed to, those identities would vanish, and they would have a different identity, and no one would know the difference. Imagine 1,000 passable identities. Now, by that I mean you've got a solid birth certificate, you've got a solid Social Security card or whatever other kind of government issued card that particular government issues. You've got maybe passports, visas, all the stuff that it takes to function and move internationally and move within whatever government that you're functioning in. Think of and I might mention, you know, my wife and I were going. My wife got her passport some time back, and I was going to go and get my passport, but I needed a birth certificate. Now, I was born in 1961, and the hospital that I was born in doesn't exist anymore. And there's no even if you go to the county that I was born, there's no there are no digital records of the hospital existing. I'm sure somewhere back in the archives of that county, somewhere on a shelf somewhere, there's records of the hospital, but nothing is available online. It's all old archive stuff. So I can't even find out the name of the hospital that I was born in, much less apply for a birth certificate from the state of California, because their system is dependent on these things. So, you know, there's some difficulty in there. Well, we have this moment, and I saw how easy it would have been. I didn't do this, but I saw how easy it would have been to just go ahead and fake it, and I could have done that. And we chose not to for a variety of reasons. First off, I'm too much in the public. My name has been out too much, and there's just too much to risk for that kind of thing. But it dawned on me that the last moments for the ability to fake records like that are right now. We're watching the final moments of the old system falling away that depended on things like, you know, stamps and signatures and things like that. That whole process is falling away, and a whole new wave of security is coming in when it comes to identities. So it's much, you know, in 2 years, it's going to be harder to have a fake birth certificate than it is today. And it's harder today than it was 2 years ago. And 10 years from now, it's going to be even harder. But imagine for yourself, if an organization had 1,000 clean, useful identities that you could show to pretty much any government worker of whatever government that this would be for, and they would accept that with no problems. They would enter it into their computer, and the computer would show that that person is all correct and all the information is correct. Imagine what 1,000 identities, what the usefulness of that could be. What if you had 1,000 people on Social Security disability? And what if 1,000 people were on disability getting $1,000 a month from Social Security disability? If 1,000 people, 1,000 identities were getting $1,000 a month from Social Security disability, that would be $1 million a month. And so what if it took 20 hackers a year to accomplish that? What kind of an impact would that make on pretty much any movement? If you could generate $1 million a month like that, 1,000 identities with 1,000 disability claims earning $1,000 a month, That's $1 million. Hackers need to wake up and think about the possibilities. Con artists need to think this through. You know, grifters, here is a challenge that can be embraced. You can spread Legos in such a way that, for fun and profit, spreading Legos for fun and profit. You know, I was thinking about that video with Carl Hess and Wilson that I referred to in the last podcast, and they were talking about turning in fake tax forms. And I was saying that that was like molasses in the engine of government, you know. And I mentioned, I think, fake arrest records for maybe government officials in the media, and maybe Photoshop scandals, anonymous leaks, that kind of thing. And if you think about that with the Walter Block quote that I read a moment ago, and you think about how useful some of these things would be under those circumstances, and you think about, like I was saying, 1,000 passports, 1,000 visas, the ability to move. Let's say you've got an activist that's endangered. Let's say there's somebody who's really important in the activist community, and they're in danger. The ability to use a situation like that and move them, let's say, to South America or to Africa or wherever, that would be critical to a movement like that. Think of the ability, and this is blending the ability of grifters and maybe the ability of con artists and hackers, although there's not a big difference between a grifter and a con artist, but they would probably say there is. But anyway, think of the usefulness if you had a team of people who had the ability to have all the papers needed to walk into a government facility and lay down all the paperwork and remove a political prisoner from out of a government's hands. Right now over in Turkey, there's a lot of protests going on, and things have the potential of turning really nasty. And, you know, the Turkish government has not been known through its history for being really tolerant. Well, what if the Turkish government was to snatch up a few of the leaders of the protests, and what if other quiet, silent, secret, underground members of that same protest could confidently march into a Turkish prison or a Turkish facility of some kind with all the proper paperwork, lay it right down in full authority and full, you know, full character, so to speak, and take that political prisoner and get them out of Turkey safely? Think of the difference that could make to a movement like that. And think how important something like that is. Again, in these situations, to move with that kind of confidence within a system, you have to know yourself, know your limits, know your capabilities, and move within those capabilities and limits. And you also have to know your enemy, know his tendencies, and understand how your enemy is going to react to things. You know, government is big, government is powerful, but government is also stupid and slow and fat and lazy. But the real thing is we need to understand why government is the things that it is. Why is government stupid and fat and slow and lazy? We need to understand those flaws, and the better we understand our enemy, the better we can exploit those flaws. A real secret to understanding how a government is and understanding its characteristics is to understand the individuals in government. What motivates this particular individual? Don't think of them collectively. Think of the one government individual that you're dealing with. What motivates them? Are they lazy? Are they greedy? Are they power hungry? Are they afraid to lose their job? Is fear their motivator? Are they misguided by a desire to do good? What is it that motivates this one individual government worker that you're dealing with? Whether you're trying to get through a gate guard, or whether you're dealing with a cop that's pulled you over on the street, or if you need some licensing thing done, this one government employee that you're dealing with, what motivates them? As you understand what motivates them, you begin to understand their strengths and their weaknesses, and then you can use those strengths and weaknesses against them and accomplish what you need to get done. And this brings me to talking about specifically recruiting and infiltrating government. You know, they attempt, the FBI, let's just say, and other governments are the same way. I'm sure, you know, MI5 and KGB or whatever their equivalent nowadays is. This is a tendency of all governments. They want to infiltrate groups, and they want to recruit people out of those groups. They want to infiltrate it with their own people, and they want to recruit people within those groups to turn on their friends. Well, we can do the same thing. We can seek out disheartened government employees, bored government employees, fearful government employees, power-hungry government employees, employees with good intentions that have maybe been passed over for advancement, people beaten down by the bureaucratic structure, people whose eyes have been opened and maybe they're stuck in the system and there's nothing they can do about it. We need to win those people's hearts and minds within the system. And then we need to be able to use them right where they are. Don't encourage them to resign. Don't encourage them to leave their job. Encourage them to find ways to be useful right where they are, right where they already work. And this goes hand in hand in what I was talking about the other day with turning government against government. And, you know, again, this can be very dangerous. We look at what was happening in Spain just the other day where the firefighters and the police were clashing. And this can be extremely dangerous situation, and it's going to get worse. It's going to get more dangerous as these things unfold. But you know, but it's also extremely useful when people see that government itself is unstable, and even those people who are in government don't believe the myths and lies of government. Then more and more it's easier for those anarchists that are above ground to point to that and say, you see, that's why government can't work. Here in the U.S., there's an organization called Oath Keepers. And I'm not a real big fan of this because they tend to be really, you know, pro-government, constitution huggers, and they're really misguided in a lot of ways. But that's an example of how you know, people within the current structure, whether the military or the government in different ways, can look at the situation they're in and realize that the government is turning into tyranny, and they can choose not to be a part of that when it happens. Think about the thing in Boston. You know, not every cop, not every soldier, not every FBI agent in Boston thought that that lockdown was a good idea. When things like that happen, we need to find the disgruntled individuals that are within those organizations and give them a voice, safely, in a way that they can, so that they don't feel that their job is threatened, they don't feel that they're physically threatened by speaking out. We need to figure out a way to reach out to those individual cops or soldiers or FBI agents or whoever that went door to door, and then in the aftermath, they thought, you know, man, that was really messed up. That was a bad thing to do, and maybe they regret it, or maybe they see that it was ineffective. You know, the whole time they're doing all of that, going door to door, harassing people, pointing rifles at children's heads, and here's this guy in this boat two blocks away, just sitting there, and they totally overlooked him. They're all of their efforts, all of the tyranny that they brought down on the citizens of Boston, were for nothing. An individual guarding his own property, checking out his own property, finds the kid in the boat, and so it completely took away any justification for that horrible tyranny. And maybe there's a cop, maybe there's more than one cop, who looks back on that and says, man, I wish I hadn't have done that. I wish I would have had a choice. I wish I wouldn't have been forced to do that. And we need to figure out a way to allow them the opportunity to say what they didn't dare say to the mainstream media when that was taking place. Now, I want to touch on something just slightly today as I wrap it up for today. And I've talked about transportation before. I talked about, you know, getting recruiting bus bus drivers, truck drivers, or even existing anarchists going into those fields, because they're going to be critical. Transportation is going to be critical to us in the near future. But I want to also mention things like riding trains. A lot of people don't think about this, but you know, I've spent a good amount of time when I was young riding trains. It's actually kind of fun. There's dangers to it. Anybody who was going to do something like that really needs to talk to somebody who's done it and understand the dangers, and also understand the conveniences. Like what kind of cars do you look for? Like hopper cars are great. How do you describe it? The hopper cars are good because in the front and in the rear they have right down where close to where the two where cars connect with other cars, where the union of the cars takes place in the turn in the buckle where they connect together. There's a place where there's a hole that you can climb back into, and even in bad weather, it's fairly tolerable back in there. And you can go through areas where there's trained people on the outside and you don't want to be spotted. You can be in that hole and they can't see you unless they get right up in there and look at you. So, you know, understanding the ins and outs of how this works is pretty critical. But once you understand how train hopping works, it's really pretty easy to move very long distances very quick without any trace that you've done it. Another thing to think about is city storm drainage systems. Pretty much all the big cities, well, I assume this. As a kid, I lived in San Jose, California. San Jose has, according to their website, they have about 1,000 miles of storm drainage system just within the city of San Jose. And when I was a little kid, and this was the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, when I was a little kid in San Jose, I could go and climb down into the storm system. And it was like a paradise for a little kid, because there was frogs and all kinds of minnows and all kinds of critters like that I could find and play with. But I could also move long distances, and I got to know the drainage system within, let's say, oh, I don't know, maybe a 20 block radius of my house when I was a kid. Because I spent quite a bit of time in there, and in the heat of the summer, it's pretty nice in there. You have to know not to be in there in the rainy season, of course. And so this is a very useful thing for any underground movement to know about. You think about the way that the underground movement worked in Warsaw during World War II, and how well they utilized the city's drainage system. I would avoid, you know, actual sewers as much as possible, but cities like Los Angeles and Las Vegas are legendary for their, you know, miles and miles of underground drainage that are dry almost all the time. In eastern cities, subways might be more of the preferable method for that. But either way, a subway's not riding the trains, I might say, but utilizing the subway tunnels. So now, there's so much more to go into. You know, I wanted to talk about in the movie Fight Club. If you're familiar with that, they recruit a lot of the groundwork people, waiters, trash truck drivers, people like that. In the movie The Terminal with Tom Hanks, you get to see this subculture that works at the airport, low-level workers at the airport that have their own culture, and they're able to do all kinds of things that security can't do anything about. This exists in reality in all kinds of layers of industry throughout any big city, or throughout the world, or throughout pretty much anything like that. So maybe in a future episode, I can talk about some of those things and how important it is to tap into the power that subculture carries with them. Because really, you know, it's those people that make everything work. It's those people, the trash collectors, the waiters, you know, the carpenters, the guys really down there on the ground. It's them that makes everything around us work. And it's them that in many ways carry the worst part of the burdens of tyrannical government. And it's them that feels that weight all the time. And they are prime candidates for us to talk to and share with and listen to and bring them in with us. Folks, thanks for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.